Jayarana Madhava Kunyabihari Jayarana Madhava Kunyabihari Gopijana Malabha Gopijana Malabha Yashodanandana Vraja Janaranjana Yashodanandana Vraja Janaranjana Yamunatira Manachari Kunyabihari Jayarandho Madhva Kunyabihari Gopijana Malabha Kiribadadari Gopijana Malabha Yashodanandana Vraja Janaranjana Yashodanandana Vraja Janaranjana Yamunatera Manachari Jayarana Madhava Kunyabihari Jayarana Madhava Kunyabihari
Jai Gaur Premananda Haribol. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Okay, one question before you begin. Do you have your original sound turned on?
We tried to follow the settings that you sent.
I couldn't find it there in the settings. Can I do it with the app open?
Use the app.
I mean, I've got this other microphone enabled. Maybe things are different when you've got a microphone.
No, it actually compresses the sound, so you can't hear the music too well.
Can I do it while I'm in the thing, or do I have to?
You can do it while you're there. Yeah. Just go in there. Go into the sound
Under audio.
and audio, and then advanced.
Advanced,
Oh, right.
That's the
That's what I
issue.
was impressing.
You see it? Then click original sound. Just tick it. You see it?
Yeah, okay.
Now go back to the regular screen. Just take that out. Then you'll see on the upper left-hand corner, as you're looking at me, it says turn on original sound. You see it?
Yeah.
Turn it on.
Okay, so that's blue, so that should be on there.
Okay, so whenever you're doing music, you should do it like that. Okay, take it away. Uh-oh.
Yeah, when you get the
Can you
box,
take
I get the
him?
baby.
It's baby time. But
Sorry, Greedo.
that's all right. This is an original composition written by Madhavasangani.
Okay, I'm doing it on the piano. I know.
That was great. That was fantastic. I'm sure everyone loved it. In the beginning, Arjuna was fooling around with some of the microphones, so it was a little crackly in the beginning, but not from you, from Arjuna.
Sorry, I wasn't sure if my voice was going to work. It didn't work very well today, so I'm sorry, but please accept my humble obeisances.
That's all right. I mean, it was very beautiful and very inspiring.
I'll try again another day. Hopefully I can get things working. I just have major vocal issues at the moment, everybody, but I'm doing my best to get on top of it.
All right. No, that was great. Very wonderful, inspiring, devotional. I'm thankful you chanted for us.
Thank you,
Gurdip. I heard it clipping, so I was moving the mic so it wasn't too loud.
Yeah. So anyway, so the sound was very good. So that's the trick to having good sound. So now we will continue and do our Bhagavad Gita study. How's that sound? So we were reading the other day, if some of you remember, from the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the first few verses. And the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is entitled Divine and Demoniac Natures. So we can find out what the nature of someone is, if they're divine, and someone if they're challenged, to use a politically correct word rather than demoniac. We don't like to use the word demoniac so well. We just say they're morally, ethically, spiritually challenged individuals. It's like nowadays you can't say that anyone's right and wrong. You just say they're challenged. Like if someone is sick, well, they're health challenged. They're not actually sick. So, with that in mind, one thing I didn't do last time is I didn't read Srila Prabhupada's purports insofar as dealing with each and every one of the qualities we were talking about. So I'd like to go back a little bit. Let me read the verse again in English. So, Om Gana Timurandasha Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Unmiritam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurvena Maha. This time, I actually have a book. I'm not used to books. I'm used to e-readers, so it'll take me a while to get used to reading a book again. Sorry about that. So, anyway, so the translation of this particular verse, or verses, 1-3, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, fearlessness. Listen, these are all important divine qualities. Purification of one's existence, cultivation of spiritual knowledge, charity, self-control, performance of sacrifice, study of the Vedas, austerity, simplicity, nonviolence, truthfulness, freedom from anger, renunciation, tranquility, aversion to fault-finding, compassion for all living entities, freedom from covetousness, gentleness, modesty, steady determination, vigor, forgiveness, fortitude, cleanliness, and freedom from envy and from the passion for honor. These are transcendental qualities, O son of Bharata, and they belong to godly men endowed with divine nature. So, maybe we should make a list and see how many of these we can tick off for ourselves, or how many of these we can't tick off for ourselves, and how many of these we can tick off for great saintly persons. So these are objective standards to determine if someone has saintly qualities. Really objective standards. Okay, so yesterday, or not yesterday, a few days ago when we were reading, we left off with Ahimsa, which was actually one of the last ones. And I wanted to go back a little bit to simplicity, which comes before Ahimsa. And I'll read Prabhupada's explanation, his purport of Ahimsa, of simplicity, sorry. So, very short explanation. As far as the Brahminical quality of simplicity is concerned, not only should a particular order of life follow this principle, but every member, be he in the Brahmachari ashram, Grihastha ashram, Vanaprastha ashram, or Sannyasa ashram, one should be simple and straightforward. So Prabhupada actually considers simplicity meaning being very straightforward rather than duplicitous. Duplicitous means basically lying. So, in other words, Prabhupada is making the point, according to one's particular situation, whether one is a student, whether one is married, whether one is retired, or whether one is, like me, sannyasi, there's different degrees or understandings of the word simplicity or the application of simplicity. So that's basically what Prabhupada is saying. So we're going to talk more about Ahimsa because that was the next quality mentioned in this particular verse. Because Ahimsa was sort of the explanation I gave of Ahimsa was sort of a controversial explanation. Because it dealt with something that many devotees are attached to, which is, I can't mention, anyway, I'll get in trouble. Which is, you can guess. Oh, so, anyway. Which, I guess I should mention. Sorry about that. Which is drinking M-I-L-K or taking milk products. And you can draw your own conclusions after hearing this particular purport by Srila Prabhupada. Ahimsa means not arresting the progressive life of any living entity. Let me just unpack that first of all. Which Srila Prabhupada will do to a certain extent later on in the purport. Arresting the spiritual life or progressive life of any living entity means that all of us, not only ourselves, but every living entity, is progressing towards a particular goal. And that goal is to actually become self-realized, to transcend this world, and eventually to transcend the cycle of birth and death. So animals, plants, and even the coronavirus is engaged in this particular endeavor. Of course, the coronavirus is not so spiritually advanced, at least as far as I can see. Please forgive me if I'm wrong. And plants are not especially spiritually advanced, and animals are not usually not spiritually advanced, although there's exceptions. And human beings in this age of Kali are not usually so spiritually advanced. But everyone is on this path in one sense, because they're working their way up. Just like if you're going to school, even though the schools are not in session right now, but if you're going to school, there's different grades in the school. There's kindy or even nursery school. And all these different grades are meant so that the individual child or student can work her or his way up to graduation. I mean, that's what school is meant for, as far as I can understand, that you graduate eventually. And so some people get held back, because nowadays I don't think they hold people back in school. They used to do that. I remember I knew someone who got held back in fifth grade three times. That's pretty embarrassing, to actually be in fifth grade three times or be 15 years old in fifth grade. Not quite. So there's this progression. So because there's a purpose to this world, and the purpose of this world is that you progress. So animals are learning something. Human beings hopefully are learning something. Of course, if you don't learn something, you can get sent back a few grades. That is, if you don't learn what you're supposed to learn in the human form of life, then you guess you got to go back a few grades and become a dog again. Although some people say that's a pretty good idea, because dogs get to sit at home and watch TV all the time while the master is out working. But that's not the sort of life that I think that any of us would like to have. So, therefore, this is, everyone's engaged in this progressive type of life. And whatever experiences we have in this world are meant to teach us so that we progress more. Whether the experience that we're having now with this, you know, virus or whatever, that is meant to teach us a lesson. Everything is meant to be a lesson. And we are meant to learn that lesson. And if we don't learn the lesson, you got to take it over again. Just like in school, you got to take it over and over and over and over and over again. And eventually, hopefully, you'll pass that particular test or lesson. So if we arrest, that means we stop or slow down someone's progress like that, that's violence. So in the human form of life, let's say I'm interacting with someone and I discourage them from spiritual life, or I give them some improper understanding of spiritual life. For example, if I say to them that spiritual life means to merge into the oneness or become God, then I'm actually arresting that person's spiritual progress. In other words, I'm violent towards that person. If I'm not telling them what the truth is, if I'm cheating, that's violence. Cheating is violence. Spiritual cheating is violence. Okay, let's continue reading the purport. Of course, now Prabhupada is talking about actually killing a living entity, because when we kill a living entity, we're also arresting their spiritual progress. One should not think that since the spirit spark is never killed, even after killing of the body, there is no harm in killing animals for sense gratification. In other words, just to please ourselves or titillate our tongue. Everybody knows the tongue. we have this verse, of course, that many of you are familiar with. Of all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious and uncontrollable. And just like a dog has a tail, but the dog wags the tail doesn't wag the dog. We have a tongue, but unfortunately, instead of wagging our tongue, of course we shouldn't wag it, instead of using our tongue, the tongue is wagging us, pulling us here and pulling us there. And other senses too, you know, tongue, belly, genitals, all these things are just like pulling us all over the place, and we think we're free, but we are worshiping our master, the tongue, or the other senses. Just like if any of you want to see who your real guru is, just look in a mirror and stick out your tongue. And that's your worshipable deity. I'm not going to stick my tongue out, don't worry. I'm not that bad. So here, Prabhupada says, people are addicted to eating animals in spite of having an ample supply of grains, fruits, and milk. And of course, not only is it violent towards the animals, it's violent towards the earth. Because when you eat animals, you're using an inordinate amount of the earth's resources. And you are making sure that your offspring will not have a good future. So, don't blame me. I mean, I'm not going to be around for this. But you may, and your offspring will certainly be around for a depleted earth. There's no necessity for animal killing. This injunction is for everyone. When there is no alternative, one may kill an animal. In other words, under certain circumstances, let us say if a snake is getting ready to kill you, fine, kill it. Prabhupada said if there's no alternative, but it should be offered in sacrifice. In other words, you may be in a particular location, such as the North Pole, which I hope never to go to, or the South Pole, and you may have to eat some penguins. That's South Pole, of course, because there's no vegetables. So, but we are not at the South Pole or North Pole. We are, let's say, in a place where there are so many vegetables and fruits growing, and unfortunately, they're shipping all these fruits and vegetables from thousands of miles away. That's not really the best thing. Basically, we should be eating locally, things growing locally. Somehow or other, we have to give up our laziness and start growing things. I mean, this people will have to learn eventually, because we are depleting. I was just watching a movie about this, but we are depleting the earth's topsoil because of this mechanized mass farming at an alarming rate, so that in 30 or 40, 50 years, there'll be no more topsoil on the earth, and we will have to just eat chemically grown food, which is really healthy for you if you happen to relish cancer and heart disease and all those other nice things. Anyway, at any rate, Prabhupada said, when there is an ample food supply for humanity, persons who are desiring to make advancement in spiritual realization should not commit violence to animals. And I think that also applies to cows. Should not commit violence to animals. This is really an important point. Real ahimsa means not checking anyone's progressive life. The animals are also making progress in their evolutionary life by transmigrating from one category of animal life to another. In other words, this is exactly what I said before. Like an animal goes up from one lifetime to another, eventually reaches human lifetime. Of course, there is a shortcut to that. The shortcut is if an animal is given prasadam, that means food offered to Krishna, or if an animal hears the holy names, the animal can actually make his way up to the human form of life pretty much immediately after he leaves that present body. So that's a benefit that we can render I mentioned the other day that, you know, inadvertently I kicked an anthill the other day. And I, in order to feel better about myself, didn't want to feel too guilty, then I chanted the holy names of Krishna to all the ants in the anthill. And certainly they were benefited. When Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was having a discussion with Haridas Thakur about this same point, Lord Chaitanya asked, in a rhetorical sense, he asked, how do inanimate living entities or lower entities, make spiritual progress? And Haridas Thakur commented that by the loud chanting of the holy names of Krishna. So we can benefit everybody by Krishna's holy name, and even animals. Prabhupada here says, if a particular animal is killed, then his progress is checked. In other words, that particular animal has to undergo a certain series of lessons in that animal body. Animals can learn. See, one of you is not on. Let me just put you on mute. I just muted someone. So that the animals can learn, not in the same way that we learn, we memorize different things from books, but an animal learns by emotional learning or subtle learning. We all have a subtle body. We have a gross body, which is the body we're walking around with, and we have a subtle body, which is like an astral body or not quite ghost body. Whoops. Please leave all your things on mute because it actually makes a disturbance. So we have a subtle body, and in that subtle body, we're actually learning things by different impressions that we have in this world. And an animal can learn too. The Prophet said, if an animal is staying in a particular body for so many days or so many years and is untimely killed, then he has to come back again in that same form of life to complete the remaining days. Whoever put your phone on, put it on mute, or else I have to do it for you.
Arjun might have two phones next to each other getting feedback.
No, they don't. No, they don't. I see it's the same person keeps doing it. All right, so anyway, so then he has to come back again, that same form of life, to complete the remaining days in order to be promoted to another species of life. So their progress should not be checked simply to satisfy one's palate. This is called ahimsa. Okay, does anyone have any questions about this ahimsa principle? And I think it's an important point. And try not to ask a controversial question of me. Uh-oh, it is Tulsi. Yes, ask your question.
Okay, so when you're thinking about the violence and arresting progress, someone, how it's violent. I mean, a lot of people, it's just because it's ignorance. Either they choose to be ignorant or they just really are ignorant. Like little kids, you know, they don't know where it all comes from. And then.
Yeah. So my response is if they're little kids, then they are not responsible for that. It's still a violent act. I think Nikunji, keep you taking yourself off of mute. So just leave it on mute.
But I mean, those little kids grow older and they're still in ignorance. You know, like Prabhupada said, the Westerners were kind of innocent.
Well.
But not so much anymore.
I think people do have responsibility for things. Yeah. I mean, even though they may not have studied the Vedas or something like that, then human beings should have a sense of ethics and morality. This is, it's pretty common sense. So, of course, you may say someone is in ignorance, just like, for example, I'm not saying I do it, but let's say I'm not going to do this. But let's say I was drunk and driving my car, and I hit someone. And my excuse was I was drunk. I was in ignorance. You know, am I responsible for hitting that person? I think so. I mean, I would be held legally responsible. So there's, of course, degrees of responsibility. After one has been given this knowledge, one has more responsibility. For a child, there's no responsibility because the child doesn't have the ability to discriminate. But if one has actually been informed about where meat comes from and understands the violence that has been there so that this meat can be produced, there is responsibility. There is moral responsibility. I mean, as moral persons or persons who have the ability to discriminate between right and wrong, then we have responsibility for that. Of course, it depends on one's level of education. And I'm not speaking about material education. For example, for myself, who has been thoroughly educated in this knowledge, to do something like that, it would be a heavier karmic activity than someone who does not have that education. As they say, with more knowledge, there's greater responsibility. Or in that movie, the famous movie, with more power, there's greater responsibility. I don't think Gopal is listening, so. No, he's not on this class. So, yes, with more knowledge, more maturity, there's greater responsibility. Does that answer the question? Yes, Veda, you have a question.
Yeah, so it's about the responsibility and how, so like living with my parents and like just these things come up and like they still eat meat. So this is like a very, it goes really well with this, but it's with other things as well where like if I talk about these like principles, they hear them and they now they know them and now they know the realities, but they don't have the desire to change that. So like is that kind of like bad on my part to be giving them this knowledge where they have like now they know and like they have the responsibility but they're just blatantly now ignoring it?
I think they pretty much knew where animals came from before. I definitely don't think you're the first one to inform them. So I don't, in this particular case, I don't think you're increasing their level of responsibility because they, in full knowledge, were doing that before. I mean, as adults, I think most adults are pretty much aware where their meat comes from. And so, at the same time, because you are connected to Krishna, and you are their well-wisher, I hope, I'm sure you are, then Krishna will give them some special dispensations. If one is connected to a Krishna-conscious person, even though, I mean, let me give you the example. Okay, let's tell a story to give that to illustrate the point. Once upon a time, there was a parent, a father who was quite, to use the word abuse would be a minimization. His name was Hiranyakashipu. I mean, he had a Vedic name. It was in the Vedic times. And he was quite an attached chap to different things. And his son was named Pallad. And his son wanted to be spiritual. And the father really didn't like spirituality too much. I mean, he definitely was not a vegetarian, to say the least. And in order to convince his son to give up his spiritual activities, he sort of threatened his son, sent him to what we would call nowadays deprogrammers. The two deprogrammers' names were Sundin and Amarka. And they attempted to dissuade him. And then the father got so frustrated when the little son couldn't be dissuaded, the father tried to kill the son in different ways. He was quite inventive, I would say, in his attempts to kill the son. Things that people don't do nowadays. Like he had him thrown off a cliff and put him under the feet of an elephant, or put him in a pit of vipers, that snakes. Did so many interesting things. I know it's cruel. But at the same time, this devotee, because he was very spiritually advanced, Krishna himself protected the devotee in all the circumstances. And after a while, this particular abusive individual met his demise in a practically a very fortunate way, which we don't have time to talk about right now, but in a very fortunate way. And after he met his demise, this the son prayed to Krishna, please help my father. And Krishna, in this particular form, in the manifestation called Nrisimhadev, he said, he said, yes, I'll liberate your father too. Your father is liberated. So that's the advantage of being associated with people who are spiritually conscious, Krishna conscious, that one's family members get benefited. And I saw that happen with my father, for example, before he passed away. He actually became a vegetarian. And he attributed his success in business. He was quite a successful businessman. Unfortunately, he didn't leave me anything. Actually, he left me a gun. I don't know what he wanted me to do with it, but he left it to me. Anyway, because he left everything to his wife. He got remarried. You know, he wasn't against Krishna consciousness. He just loved his wife more. So I gave that gun away to a friend of mine here in North Carolina, and this friend loves guns so much that he told me it was the best gift he got in his whole life. This is American. This is America for you, you know. Gun culture. So anyway, my father became very favorable. My mother doesn't even remember my legal name anymore. You know, when I call her up on the phone, I say, this is your son, da, 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 whatever my legal name is. Of course, I remember. She says, who's that? She said, my son's name is Bir Krishna. I said, wow, you are making spiritual advancements. So so I think that there's hope. When a devotee is a well-wisher of others, that creates one's good fortune. So as far as your parents, and also they have certain habits of doing things the way they've done for their whole lives, it's hard to change. I gave up directly trying to change my parents because it had adverse effects. My parents, my father in particular, got pretty upset with me for trying to change him, but he changed automatically by my being engaged in devotional service and my being loving with my parents. And, you know, all's well that ends well, like that. So sometimes it's better not to speak to people who are not ready to hear certain things. That's basically my strategy, that I'm very careful what I tell people. Of course, about this meat eating, I'm always very direct with people because it's a no-brainer. It's not like some high philosophy or transcendental or you're not the body, you know, things that are just like, what? You know, if I were to tell a psychiatrist you're not the body, he would think I have disassociation tendencies. I have schizophrenia. So there's an interesting story about a psychiatrist in me. Once upon a time, my father was thinking I had gone crazy. This is when I first took up Krishna consciousness. He thought I'd gone crazy and he wanted to save me. So he enlisted the help of a friend who was a psychiatrist. So I was visiting my father one time, and he introduced me to his psychiatrist friend. And the friend, a nice man, and my father said, "Oh, I have to go somewhere, and I'll be back in a little while." Little did I realize that little while was about 2 hours, and he was leaving me alone with the psychiatrist. It's like a trick. So the psychiatrist asked me, first thing he asked, "Are you happy?" And I sort of turned it around on him, and I said to him, "Yes, but my question is, are you happy and fulfilled in life?" And so we had this discussion, and the poor psychiatrist didn't know whether he was sane by the time he finished with me. And he told my father, "You know, he's okay." I don't know if the psychiatrist was okay after he dealt with me, but at least he told my father I was okay. So in general, yes, we do have to be cautious, but as far as meat eating in a gentle way, sometimes it doesn't come out gentle. I think I told you or some of the devotees the other day that one time, it was a few months ago, I was speaking to my mother, and she was telling me how she was enjoying eating chicken, and I couldn't control myself, and I said, "Mother, you're cannibal." She got pretty upset. She said, "What? How can you say I'm a cannibal?" I said, "You're eating, living into, you're eating the poor chickens. How would you like it if you were a chicken?" And that conversation didn't go very far. So I sort of gave up talking to her about that. And anyway, so it's a touchy thing. However, because you're engaged in spiritual life, that actually will mitigate what your parents are doing. I mean, it's amazing. Because if the parents are responsible for bringing up someone, and if someone takes up spiritual life, the parents get the benefit or the benediction of having brought that person up in spiritual life. Kind of nice. So, thank you for the question, Veda. It was a good question. Because people really don't change too much by explaining the facts. Especially, I think, children talking to parents very rarely can change parents. Usually it has to be someone senior. And then they can get away with a lot more. And that's why I'm enjoying being old, because I can get away with so much and tell people so many things, and they're not allowed to get offended with me. Because no one can get offended with a senior person. So, very good. So, anybody else have a question about ahimsa? Before we go on.
Dhanvat Pranam.
Yeah.
Dhanvat Pranam Maharaj, my name is Abhiram Nitai Gore. Das,
yeah. Please accept. Hi, nice to see you. I can't see you, but I can hear you.
Yeah, please accept my humble obeisances. I'm a disciple of His Holiness, Srila Jayapataka Swami Maharaj.
Very nice.
And yeah. So I have a question, Maharaj. In the Vedas, in regards of animal killing or animal sacrifice, they mention that there is a certain type of the animal sacrifices which has to be done as per the Vedas. Can you describe it a bit of this in the subject matter?
Yeah, well, that type of animal sacrifice is not really meant for this day and age. As you're aware, Ekon Dharma, Krishna Nam Sankirtan, that in this day and age there's one specific dharma, which is Krishna Nam Sankirtan, the chanting of Krishna's names. That type of sacrifice was actually meant to rejuvenate the animal and give the animal a new body. In other words, it was a mystical performance whereby the animal would enter into the sacrifice and then come out again in a new body. I mean, that's pretty mystical. In other words, there's no real killing per se. The animal would actually manifest himself or herself or itself or dog self in a new form, and sometimes even a human form. So it was actually a scientific form of transmutation is something different, transmigration. And the brahmanas were so effective and so spiritual and so expert that they could actually do that in those days. Yogis can do so many amazing things, what to speak of the brahmanas. The yogis, and even now in the Himalayas, there are some yogis like this who can go bathing in one river and come up with another river, who could float in the air. Just like there was this very nice book written by Radhanath Maharaj, Journey Home, in which he describes that he was staying with some yogis and he woke up in the morning and he saw these yogis floating in the air. I mean, I can't do that without the help of some balloons or something. I'm not capable of floating in the air. But, you know, sometimes you get these spiritually powerful people who can do things and rejuvenate animals and give them new bodies. And that's the meaning of a Vedic sacrifice. And it's not recommended for this day and age. And okay.
Okay? Okay. Thank you very much, Mark.
All right, thank you. Nice question. And that's not violence. If you can actually rejuvenate someone, like if someone could do a sacrifice with me right now and turn me into a 30-year-old version of myself, I'm all for it. Cool. You know, I'm ready to go. But I want you to try it on someone else first, not me. Don't try it on me first, because I still got some life left in me. So any other questions about ahimsa or the application of ahimsa? It's a very interesting point.
I have one, Shruti Gurudev.
Yeah. Who's that, Shruti? Oh, yeah, Shruti. Okay.
Okay.
We can't see your smiling face.
I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. Hi. Okay. Okay. I guess one, I've heard that, you know,
one asked when I was explaining this principle one time, you know, what happens if you're starving or there's no other source. And, you know, and so I explained that some people said that that's okay, but then, you know, it's kind of contradictory. And I was wondering, like, in survival mode, is it, I don't know, I wouldn't, obviously, but like, you know,
I get the question.
Okay. All right. So
the question is, are you going to die? Mm-hmm. And preferable and better than dying is maybe taking some lower creature like a fish or something. Yes.
Lower your consciousness though, and like defeat the purpose of like raising it.
Well, I think if you die because of starvation, it definitely lowers your consciousness too. I think if one there's certain extenuating circumstances.
Okay.
But a cow is never meant to be killed under any condition or hurt under any condition, but their survival. Okay. I mean, we're not in that situation. If you were at, as I mentioned before, the North or South Pole, then you might be in that situation. But it's very doubtful that any of us will ever find ourselves in a situation like that. Particularly if you go to the forest, there's so many nuts and things you can eat in the forest and greens you can eat in the forest and different things like that. You can live. I mean, just like today, I was walking in the field and there were dandelions there. And, you know, the greens that come from dandelions can be eaten, right? So it's like that. So don't worry.
The flowers too.
Don't worry, be happy. You will not be put in that, you will not be put in that situation.
No, I'm not worried.
Okay.
No worries.
Okay.
And then
what's that? What else?
What about, you know, you were discussing how it's you know, it's everybody's responsibility once they reach a certain age to make that decision.
Ability to discriminate. But, I would say ability to discriminate. I mean, certain people, if they have some lack of mental faculties, then they would not be responsible. Okay. It's not a question of age. It's a question of the ability to discriminate and make ethical or moral judgments.
Okay. Okay, I think that's it. Okay.
Okay. Anyone
all
else?
Right,
about anyone else about ahimsa? Actually, we didn't get very far today. We just
I've
made.
Got... Question. Right.
Okay, Namaruchi.
So I talked to lots of people who eat meat because that's basically most of the population here, and they like the idea of being vegetarian. They just don't. They just don't want to take it, and they say, "Oh, the animals just been killed," and they say it's okay, and they say because they're free range, so called, and
yeah.
The best thing to do to them, you can't debate to them. Should you just association, and by
best
time
thing
they
is,
will change.
Best thing is give them prasadam and show them that there are ways to enjoy eating without killing animals. I mean, very few people know how to eat nicely with vegetarian food. For example, when I decided to be a vegetarian, I didn't know how to do it. I mean, I think I was about 18, 17, 18, whatever. My mother was very upset with me. And I thought, you know, all I could figure out was just salad and spaghetti. And yogurt. That's all I could figure out. Then later on, I learned how to cook some vegetarian dishes, and now I cook every day for myself, particularly since I'm in isolation. I have to cook for myself every day. And today I had quinoa. Yesterday I had quinoa. The day before I had quinoa. The day before I had quinoa. And the day before I had quinoa. And the day before I had quinoa. And the day before. And I'm happy. But I know how to make a variety of things. But it takes some knowledge. If we can show people how vegetarian food can be tasty or even tastier than other types of food, then people will change. That's why Prabhupada wanted some vegetarian restaurants in different places to convince people. Then, you know, the health reasons, the ecological reasons, the ethical reasons. I mean, we can go all the way down the list here. But there's many valid reasons for not eating animals. Karmic reasons like that. For me, it's an emotional reason too. That's very important. For me to think that what I'm doing would cause harm to anybody is too painful for me to bear. Whether it's talking about verbally harming someone or in any other way harming someone, I just personally I can't bear it. It's painful. So anyway, that's just my own personal outlook on things. So any other questions? Actually, we've gone on for more than an hour. Oh.
Gurudev.
Hare Krishna. Oh, Nalini Kant. I don't see your smiling face either. And then we'll take Leela Shakti to say. Oh, my God. Better put your mask on. I don't want to get the virus. Where are you?
I'm in the clinic, Gurudev.
Oh, my God. You're all right?
Yes, Gurudev.
All right, so what's up?
Gurudev, now sometimes while talking about vegetarianism to people who eat meat, they challenge ourselves that you're talking about compassion and not to kill animals, but plants and vegetables, they also have souls. So, and we try to describe that, we try to explain that, we need to survive on something, and Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita what we can offer to Krishna.
Right.
And when we offer to Krishna, he removes sinful actions from that, and additional other sins as well.
Right.
But they are not like convinced with that theory, and then they how to convince them what to
say
to
them. Obviously then you can't just quote the Bhagavad Gita people. What I would say, if you can't see the difference between cutting an animal's throat and cutting a piece of broccoli, you got problems, buddy.
Yeah.
I mean, you could explain in terms of the developed nervous system of the different entities, the amount of pain that they experience. Certainly, we should be very cautious about not harming any living entity, such as, you know, a broccoli or what other type of vegetable you're talking about. At the same, and we should actually be thinking. I mean, I know the American Indians used to actually pray to God or pray to the living entity who's, in terms of who they were killing or whatever, understanding that the act of violence, even with a vegetable, was absolutely necessary. So there has to be, in other words, I wouldn't try to convince them, but I would just say to them, there's a vast amount of difference between killing an animal and cutting a vegetable. I mean, that's common sense. I mean, if people don't understand that, then Hare Krishna, there's nothing you can do.
I tried to explain about how tree and plants, their consciousness is so covered and their senses for the pain are less and things like
that.
They were unable to convince.
Don't try. Then what I would do, just basically give people movies to watch about these particular subject matters, particularly about ecology, how the earth is being decimated, about health, and let people make their own choices. We can't force people. I mean, I think people change nowadays more visually than orally.
Okay.
You understand what I mean? When they see something, it strikes them.
Okay.
For example, when people talk to me about cows, because I've been with cows, I've taken care of cows, and I know how cows feel, I can actually relate to it. But for many people, it's very theoretical in the head. So perhaps it's better to show them some videos.
Okay.
And I can, if you're interested, I can recommend some videos for you later on to show them. But
okay,
then everyone has their choice. I mean, we can't interfere with people's choices, and everyone has to take the results of their choices in life. That's the way life is. Okay?
Okay, thank you, Gurudev.
All right, and one more question from Leela Shakti, I think.
Guru Maharaj.
Whoop. Uh-oh. we have Draupadi and Leela Shakti. Who goes first?
Okay.
Let Draupadi go first.
Guru Maharaj, I just want to know, the Muslim community, they do Qurbani once a year. And they share meat. They kill a cow or a bullock, and then they share among themselves. I just want to know if they are committing sin in this thing, because I always...
Yes, it's not in the Quran to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, there were no cows. When Muhammad was there in the desert in Arabia, there were no cows there. So for them to say this is part of their religious ritual is, I mean, they're just fooling themselves, because Muhammad never ate a cow because there were no cows there. I mean... they might have eaten camels or whatever they ate, but they certainly didn't eat cows or oxen or anything like that. So they made up this ritual, but, you know, there's so many rituals. I mean, I was born in a religion where there are rituals for killing animals, too. And, you know, I'm not doing it. And there's many people who are members still of the religion which I was brought up in who became vegetarians and don't do it. It's a matter of, we don't do things because it's what we were brought up doing, or it's our part of our culture, or what our parents are. We have individual responsibility. We're not, like nowadays they talk about herd immunity, but there's also herd consciousness, in which people of a herd, you know, whether you're a student, the student herd, or the, you know, whatever, political herd. Just like you see, I mean, in America, not that I want to get into politics, you have some political herd, and they all try to speak with one voice. But we should be individuals and make individual moral and ethical choices in our lives, no matter what our religion is. And there are some vegetarian Muslims, too. Okay, thank you. And one final question, as it's getting late, from Leela Shakti.
So a common objection that I hear from particularly devotees about being vegan or going vegan is that we should try to help these poor cows out of the cycle of birth and death by offering their milk to Krishna, and thereby they receive some spiritual benefit for having offered that milk to Krishna.
Okay, so the more milk you buy, the more cows will be slaughtered. That's the law of supply and demand. Anyone who's gone and taken economics 101 in the university, and which I did take, then you'll learn about supply and demand. And if you really increase the demand, you ultimately the supply increases over time. So why should we want more cows to be slaughtered so that we can offer their milk to Krishna? It's just like saying, should I kill my mother so I could get my inheritance and offer the money to Krishna so she'll get benefited? Whew. Oh, my God. Certainly if my mother leaves me something, I will use it for Krishna's service. But, you know, should you kill someone for it? I don't. You know, when you buy something in the store, you're indirectly responsible for the violence that went into that particular product. People will say, for example, if they buy meat, I didn't kill it. I didn't kill the cow or the pig or whatever animal it was. But you paid for the animal to be killed, directly or indirectly. Let's say you're a member of the mafia and you have someone you want to hit, you know, kill. So you don't do it directly if you happen to be one of the big bosses. You hire someone to do it, or you hire someone who hires someone who hires someone who hires someone. Still, you are responsible under the law. Whether you did it, you paid for it, you paid for someone else to do it, or you paid for someone else to pay someone else to do it, you are responsible. So we're responsible for this violence. I mean, personally, the only explanation I can give people, because people are very attached to things, is I personally cannot deal with the fact that I'm causing harm to another living entity. For me, emotionally, it's devastating. Even if you don't agree with me philosophically, emotionally, I can't cope with it. So you may think that I have emotional problems and want to send me to a psychiatrist because I have emotional problems, but this is my emotional life. So that's how I deal with it, because I don't want to bring it to the philosophical platform. With philosophy, if you are expert, you can argue any point and spend the next 10 years going back and forth on it. And if any of you have ever been to law school, you know in law school they actually ask you to take the same position, one position, and then the opposite position, and argue for both of those positions. That's just the way lawyers are trained. So there's no benefit in argumentation. In fact, there's one verse in the Mahabharata that says, Tarko Pratishta, Shruti Navibina. And I'm not going to give you the whole verse. But it says, by argumentation and logic, you're not going to establish what is true and what is not true. And the answer, the end of it, is Mahajaniyena Gata Sapanta. One can only understand what is to be done, what is not to be done, by following the example given by these great spiritual personalities. Mahajanite means great spiritual personality, or great. Maha means great, jana means person. So this is the Vedic version. So anyway, on that happy note, having not gotten any further in this verse that we had last time, next time we'll go on to Satyam, that means truthfulness, and some of the other qualities. So we may spend a few weeks or a few months going over these groups of verses. So we want to thank you very much, everybody, for joining us, especially the musicians. And we got Maha Mantra there. I don't see Madhu Sangani. I guess they're not on anymore because they have babies to take care of. And in Fiji, we got devotees in Fiji. We got devotees in maybe in Australia, I'm not sure. New Zealand, you got devotees in the United States. And anywhere else that I leave out? Oh, there. Madhava Sangani is there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gurudev.
Yeah, they're great disciples in New Zealand. And you see, we got devotees from all over. Okay. Thank you all. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna.